You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
I'm with Harrison Querry, ladies and gentlemen. This is The Brian Callen Show, the mother of all shows. Harrison and I are sitting in my fucking office slash garage. It's 1 o'clock, and he was a young man who used to listen to the Joe Rogan podcast. He sent me something. I said, I'll read 10 minutes of it. I was on the plane, read it on my phone, sent me a script. I ended up reading the whole fucking thing and called him. You were how old at the time?
20.
Young. You were 20.
Yeah.
You're how old now?
25.
You're 25, and you just did rewrites for Christopher Columbus's new script movie. You're now working on something else. Can you talk about it or no?
I can, yeah. I can talk about a couple of them. I just was fortunately hired to write John Hillcoat's next film for Cross
Creek. And what did John Hillcoat do?
He is the director of many fine films, including The Proposition, Lawless with Tom Hardy, recently Triple Nine with Kate Winslet and Casey.
So you're a 25-year-old writer in Hollywood who's actually getting paid to write and writing significant projects with significant people at 25.
That's the idea.
What a dick. Who do you think you are? You think you're the Justin Bieber of the writing world?
Well, you've already undersold your own role in the whole story.
Well, it doesn't matter.
Well, it does. I mean, it's fortunately been every meeting I've ever taken's opening salvo when people ask me how I got started. It wasn't simply I sent Brian something. I was listening to the Joe Rogan podcast way back in the day when you guys were, I don't even think you were in a studio. It looked like you were in someone's living room.
Yeah.
And you're telling a story on the podcast and you start blurting your phone number out and Joe stops
no,
you.
Like, Jimmy Burke did because he was hi.
Yeah, someone starts saying your phone number.
Around, yeah.
But it wasn't your old phone number.
I think you, I actually
it was all
forgot
but
about
two
this.
Digits.
You texted me.
It was all but two digits of your phone number. Oh. And so I'm literally sitting on my couch dialing random combinations of the last two digits, calling people, and half of them, you know, were wrong numbers, obviously, and the other half weren't even real numbers. And finally I got your voicemail, got nervous and hung up. And then I sent you this fucking long
text. Well,
that's
right. Now I remember this because
you called me.
Yeah,
like,
your
dude,
text.
Who the fuck are you?
Well, your text was eloquent and it was thoughtful, and I appreciated it. I appreciated the hustle. I appreciated the fact that you took a risk. But it was I could tell right away that you were different and you were thoughtful and you were. So yeah, I think I called. Did I call you?
You called and you. What
I
like,
say? I go. What
you were laughing. You're like, who the fuck are you? Yeah. And
I was like, you can't fucking call me. Although I've been a young, hungry artist. Or whatever you want to call it, and I understood it. So I it was
you did.
Endearing.
You were very gracious, and you gave me your email, and you said, "Go ahead, send me whatever it is you want to send me." So
I realized in 10 pages that you were just different. I mean, you know.
Well, I didn't think you'd read it. I sent it to you, and then you called me. Whatever it was, 10 days, 2 weeks later,
talking to the mic,
and you had been on a flight, and you had read it. And
yeah.
Responded to it, and
it was so dark too. It was like it was very interesting. It was this. It was a very interesting. Like very, there were moments that were visceral for me because he kills a girl.
Yeah.
And he comes out and he goes, like it was exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
And he was fat. And I pictured a fat, jowly, 50-something-year-old, 60-something-year-old man.
Yeah.
And he said something like, you better get a mop.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I went, fuck, this, you know, this young man knows how to write a murder scene because so much of the scene was what you didn't say in it.
Yeah.
And I went, this is a real writer.
Yeah, you don't see the scene. You just see him walk outside and talk to one of his bodyguards.
But at 25 years old, you know, you have to know that you're such a rare commodity because it's one thing to be, I was talking about this, the Asian community, for example, all due respect, and I have a lot of respect for the Asian community, but I'm talking about ethnically Chinese,
right.
Ethnically Korean. And they have a lot to offer, of course. Mm-hmm. But they take their children and they say, you're going to learn the violin. You're going to get straight A's. You're going to get into Harvard. And we're going to go from there.
Right.
And a lot of other things. Problem is that it's one thing to master an instrument with other people's music.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to be a very good student and do what you're told to the nth degree. It's quite another thing to create something out of nothing, which is what you did. Now, I know your father's a restaurateur and an entrepreneur, but you do this well and have done this well from a very early age.
Yeah.
It's rare in this culture. I think we come and we are in a culture and a time where people like Dan Bilzerian and Kim Kardashian and It's okay, Kanye West, I'm good artist, but you know, it's okay to worship yourself.
Right.
It's okay to sort of never reach beyond yourself, and in a lot of ways, you know, you yourself become the measure of all things. You've avoided that. You've been raised well. But I don't even think you went to college, did you?
I went to a couple years of college, did a little studying in London and then a little studying at CU in Boulder, but I stopped. I mean, once I knew that I wanted to write, if you really want to write, you just need to be writing.
Why and how, and tell me your story.
Well, I was studying to write, knew that I wanted to write, and was trying to figure out how, and doing shit like stealing your phone number and getting in touch with you know people like you. Before that, before you and I got in touch, I had similarly kind of reached out to some people that I wanted to talk to, one of whom was Michael Arndt, who is at the time, I mean, he's a monster writer. He wrote and won an Oscar for Little Miss Sunshine,
wow,
has since written the new Star Wars film. He wrote, won an Oscar for Toy Story 3. He's the biggest fucking guy in the game.
What's his name?
Michael Arndt.
This is my business and I don't know it.
Yeah, he's
God, he's a beast.
He's amazing. And at the time, you know, was a monster at the time as well. And, for whatever reason, generously responded to one of my letters, agreed to get on the phone with me, and we had this long 2-hour conversation. And, you know, having been exposed to some of my stuff and just talking to me after a while, he kind of went out on a ledge and was like, dude, drop out of college. You know, if you really want to do this, start fucking writing and do it. You know, you're not going to learn.
But you have some, you have, I suppose, wisdom. You know, wisdom can be defined, I heard it defined as coming to terms and learning how to and what to do with your own limitations. That takes time. I'm 50 almost, and I think I'm getting to a point where I'm to a point where I have some of that.
Right.
Not a lot of it. But you seem to be, for lack of a better word, a new age, you know, an old soul. Where's that come from?
I mean, you know, encountering limitations was definitely a theme for me early on. I had was born with heart condition, had 7 open heart surgeries, the first of which was at 7 days old, and my whole childhood was in and out of hospitals.
Really? Your whole childhood?
Yeah. And
interesting.
Up until, you know, and pretty, you know, at times pretty serious, dire life and death situations. You know, luckily by the time I was in, you know, late elementary school, middle school, I came out the other end of it, was given no real restrictions by my doctors, I could do whatever workouts I wanted, play any sports. It was, you know, go for it. Had a pacemaker put in when I was 10, maybe. So, you know, there was definitely an early encounter with despite the fact that the doctor
said,
were
you cognizant as a kid that you could die?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Sure.
You were cognizant of the fact that, what does it feel like to have a weak heart?
You know, luckily, just the nature of my particular condition, it wasn't so much a weak heart. It was more just a valve thing that kept coming back that they had to go in and fix multiple times.
But how would they know? You just feel it?
Yeah. I mean, when you're a baby, my mom brought me to the hospital the first time because I had turned blue. You know, I turned blue and they fucking helicoptered me. It was emergency surgery.
Jesus.
And then later on, you know, symptoms manifest in kids in different ways. But, you know, it definitely was.
It was humbling.
Very much so. And very, you know, it was.
You're a tall, strapping guy.
Yeah. And I'm lucky. I mean, I did. I mean, that was a big part of, you know, it was most kids with a pacemaker, they're not boxing.
Yeah.
And that was something that I couldn't really, you know, even tell my cardiologist. And honestly, didn't even really tell my parents about it to the extent that I, you know, they paid for my boxing gym membership. And it was, I'm going to go in and hit the bags and whatever. And I would go in and spar. And I didn't even at times, I mean, it was very stupid in retrospect, tell the people I was sparring with that I had a pacemaker.
Yeah.
Which was fucking crazy.
Because you could get punched in the heart or...
Well, you could theoretically break it. And even if you did, luckily my condition, I wouldn't drop dead. But it's not a good, you know, it's not a good smart thing to be doing.
Yeah.
But
or
it
maybe,
was...
Or maybe it is.
Maybe it was. I mean, for me, it was crucial at the time. There was so much insecurity and so much...
So it was.
Yeah, it was big. I mean, for me, it was kind of the only way that I could come into any kind of sense of masculinity or
objective,
you know,
reality, getting punched. Well, you'd had enough of that, but
yeah, but it's, you know,
there's something about I still box that way. That's the reason I do it, because I get nervous when my trainer, Wayne McCulloch, says, bring your headgear.
Right.
I go, ah, fuck.
Yeah.
Who am I going to spar? Is this guy going to be athletic?
Mm-hmm.
Am I going to get caught in the chin? Mm-hmm. Am I going to break my nose? I don't like it. And by the way, I shouldn't be doing it at my age.
Yeah. I shouldn't have been doing it at all.
Yeah.
Either,
but by the way, yes, I should be.
Right. I mean, there's value to it, and I wouldn't, you know, take it back. For me, it was a personal thing. It was definitely an ego thing and an insecurity thing. I think that, you know, going to school and watching kids on the football team and walking around with this pacemaker, I felt like, fuck, I don't feel tough. Mm-hmm. And I desperately wanted to be. I wanted to be a fucking strapping badass. Mm-hmm. And so if I can go in there and I might have to bullshit my parents and not necessarily tell them everything I'm doing, or, you know, tell them that the black eye that I had was from, oh, I was just messing around kind of in the ring with someone and he slipped and he accidentally hit me. But for me, I felt great. I felt better than I had ever, really.
Yeah.
Felt tough. But, you know, the combination of those experiences, it was never going to be a sort of prescribed path for me. You know, my brother's in law school and is brilliant and is doing his thing, but that kind of path was never going to be something that I think I could have done. Just because from an early age, it felt like, all right, there's a sense of urgency here.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure. So it was urgency. It was the idea that maybe I don't have that much time.
Maybe I don't have that much time, which can manifest in different...
It's fucking great, though.
Yeah, it's great. And it can manifest weirdly in different ways. It sounds, when I say that, it sounds as though I might have been living this incredibly aggressive path where I know exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going after it because I could die at any minute. But sometimes that sense of ticking clock can manifest in paralysis. Mm. And there were definitely periods early on where I felt like I wasn't doing anything. And
by the way, when you say this, it sounds like you were 16, 17.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, most kids are getting fucking high and playing video games.
Yeah. Well, I had started kind of the thing. I finished up high school a couple years early as sort of part of this general urgency. Really wanted to get out of high school. So I figured out through independent study, and my district allowed for this thing where you could basically take on your coursework on your own as long as you could test out and prove that you had, you know, tested out of the various levels, you could graduate. So I did that early and, you know, was going to go into film production, or thought I maybe wanted to be an editor or a director or whatever it was going to be. It was just kind of frenzied. I can't just sit here in high school.
Right.
But it was up, you know, there were times where it manifested like that, and then times where it was, fuck, I don't know what to do. And, you know, it becomes more of an anxiety kind of uncertainty. But luckily,
but you know, writers tend to have this thing where when they're not writing, certainly stand up for me, you know, it's funny. I just had a killer set tonight, but this is stupid to talk about, but I was at the Laugh Factory and it was a sold out house, and my wife was there, and I was like, and Dana White was there and Matt Serra was there. And I was like, you know, I'm going to fucking blow the doors off this place because I've been doing it long enough where I have a bag of tricks.
Right.
So, you know, I can try new stuff, or I can do stuff I know is going to fucking destroy because I've been doing it.
Right.
And, I'm always down on myself for not writing enough. But I write every day, or at least I worry about not writing. Mm-hmm. So I did a bunch of stuff tonight, and of course, blah, 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 I guess what? I can make people laugh really hard. I've been doing it forever. It's what I do.
Right.
It's just a bag of tricks. But my wife looked at me and she goes, that was all new. Mm. I haven't seen any of that. And I thought, you haven't?
Mm.
Boy, I thought I was doing tried and true stuff. Well, no, I've been writing.
Right.
I've been writing. It just didn't dawn on me. I was, you know, when I got off stage, everybody was laughing, but you know, you think, wow. But for me, I don't mean this to sound cocky. What I mean this to sound is almost like, you know, a surgeon does open heart surgery. They do it all the time.
Right.
And you go, whoa, you can do open heart surgery. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I've been doing it forever.
Right.
You know, if it's the first time you've seen something, you might go, that guy can really do open heart surgery. Well, it's a little bit the same thing. You know, stand up, I have a monologue. I have a lot of material that has been tried and true. So it's not that, it's like a magic trick.
Right.
It's not that big a deal. However, you get hard on yourself and then you realize that the work is paying off somehow, because guess what? It is new, because guess what? I am moving the needle, you know, in my own way. But there's always that nagging sort of thing where I feel like I'm not doing enough.
Yeah. Right?
Like I always feel like I should be trying to be as original, like to be able to be as original as someone like, I don't know, you name it.
Right.
Whether it's Shakespeare or Newton. I really wonder what those people thought about their lives when they look back on it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like a sense of dissatisfaction with whatever the work is that you're currently coming out with is a constant and kind of a necessary.
That's
constant.
Funny. So when you're done with it, you just, you know, you have some disdain.
Yeah, fuck
on
this
the same way,
yeah.
dude.
Fuck what I just wrote. By the time I'm done with the script, I don't even want to read it.
God.
Humiliated when I send it out, and I'm a wreck until I get feedback that's positive. And if it's not positive.
I am the same fucking way.
If it, yeah, it's inevitable. I mean.
I hate it.
Yeah.
My special. I worked hard on it and I you know, and I released it on my own and I'm going to release it some more, but you know, I guess people liked it. I you know, I can't stand a lot of it.
I don't know many good writers or artists in general who are very pleased with their own work. I don't think that is part of the deal. I don't think you can be, and I don't know that you want to be. I mean, I think that constantly doing better stuff, part of that is having some kind of part of you that's just unsatisfied with what you're doing. You know, if I when I sit down to write something, a big part of what pushes me is thinking back on the last thing I wrote and thinking that wasn't as good as I want this to be.
Right.
I want this to be the one that's really good, and it's not going to be, and I'm going to hate it and send it out. And, you know, years later and as time passes, I can look back at stuff and be proud of it and enjoy it. But, you know, I don't know. I think that staying a little bit of a head case in that way is kind of crucial.
I agree with you. A head case is like longing, dissatisfaction, even a little self-loathing.
Yeah, and it sounds like the corny classic tortured writer thing, but it's kind of true. It's kind of real.
But we live in a society and a culture that says things like believe in yourself. You got to love yourself. I actually disagree.
No.
I don't know that loving yourself and believing in yourself, I don't know if that, I think believing in your potential,
sure.
I think believing in the fact that inside you somewhere, if you know where and how to mine it,
right.
something great can live. That's a good, that's believing in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But we use these words and I don't even know what the fuck they mean. What do you mean look within? What are you talking about? Oh, you mean pull my hair out until I come up with a good idea? Write and say I suck and keep doing it and somehow, you know, life is a process of slow attrition and slow erosion, in my opinion.
Yeah. I all the best things I feel like I've done or accomplished have come from a place of not liking who I was or what I was doing.
I agree.
Or feeling insecure, whether it was learning how to box because I felt like a pussy or writing something really good because I felt like, all right, I'm not going to be a fucking quarterback. How am I going to be
accomplished? John Irving said, you know, Charlie Rose said, what drives you? He said, a profound sense of my own inadequacies.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You know, I mean, that, and Charlie Rose said, pretty much everybody I know, except for some athletes, say the same thing.
Well, there is an enormous amount of ego, I think, in writing, too. I mean, just the notion of, I'm going to professionally write things that come from my head and presume that they are of value to the world. I'm going to sit down and make up a fucking story, and I'm bold enough.
What an act of faith, by the way.
And an act of ridiculous, sort of self-congratulatory egoism to submit something that I wrote and actually have the audacity to think not only should someone pay me for this, but strangers should sit down and watch it.
But they are.
Yeah. And so
what's been surprising to you about the business?
Fuck. I mean, you know, I'd like to say, like,
what's the advice?
Fuck.
Cause you're 25. So fuck your advice.
Yeah. I mean, shit.
But I want to hear it.
I'm certainly by no means an expert on anything, but you know, I think I, like a lot of people, certainly people my age, look at just the amount of shit that Hollywood produces and you think, wow, what a bunch of dummies. Easy is the wrong word. How exciting it's going to be for me to bring something that's cool and smart to the table because clearly they're out of ideas. Look at all this shit. Something that is kind of a heartbreaking but also kind of exciting discovery is that they're not stupid. The people who are coming out with the Transformers and the fucking Ninja Turtles 9 and all the sequels that suck and the trailer after trailer that you watch and think, I would never pay to see that movie, but for some reason they break box office records. The people who are making those like the same movies we do. That's a very calculated decision they're making. That's a business decision. And I think I think a lot of people expect the level of stupidity they see on the screen to be reflected in the people making those products. That's not the case at all. The people who are making them have oftentimes just as good taste as everyone else. They like all the, you know, really good award-winning movies. They don't like the stuff they're making.
Yeah.
They're just doing it because it's business.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is kind of a heartbreaking...
But isn't it? But that's the danger of having too much to manage, right, for an artist. My feeling is that, you know, I looked at a house today, and it's expensive, but I want it badly. And I thought to myself... Like, the first thing I thought to myself was, boy, I got to get more sponsors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not what I signed up for.
Right.
It's not who I want to be. I don't want to have to do things because I'm paying for a fucking house.
Yeah.
And that's what you have to guard against. I'm not even so sure that's good for my kids.
Right.
You know, there's a lot that one must guard against when it comes to creature comforts.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It can dull your sword.
Yeah. There, and it's tough too. You know, you get going and you have a couple successes and people start offering to pay you to write things, and some of the shit that you get offered is terrible, and you know it's stupid, but it's real money.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it takes a certain amount of discipline that I definitely haven't always had to turn that shit down. I have other writers who I have a lot more respect for than myself who won't do it.
Springsteen said one of his favorite pastimes is to sit around and calculate the amount of money he's not made.
Yeah.
By saying no to every endorsement deal that's come down the pipe.
Yeah.
You never see him endorse a goddamn thing.
And I have there's a director who's I think I can comfortably call him a friend and definitely a bit of a mentor. He directed a film called Assassination of Jesse James.
Oh yeah.
And Killing Them Softly with Brad Pitt a couple years ago. He's done only a handful of films, great films, not films that have made a lot of money, but he's a very respected director and, you know, has certainly had everything under the sun What's thrown at him. Andrew Dominik. Mm-hmm. Everything under the sun from fucking comic book movies to franchises thrown at him. And you talk to him, he's like, I don't like it. Don't want to do it. And I mean, the amount of money.
See, that shouldn't be news.
Yeah.
It's called staying true to yourself. It's called common decency.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, God damn it. Why is that so noble? It is noble, but it shouldn't be.
I think that it's just shocking for people. The fact that most people spend their lives doing something they don't want to do for a meager payday. The idea that someone would turn down something as seemingly enjoyable as directing a movie of any kind and turn that down to the tune of millions of dollars, people just cannot believe it.
Well, I was thinking about that. Like, if Coca-Cola came to me and said, we want to sponsor your podcast.
Right.
I'd say no.
Right.
Because that money would, first of all, I don't use the product.
Right.
So I can't tell my fans... I'm talking about The Fighter and the Kid, not this podcast. But I can't tell the fans to buy something I don't use or that I kind of disapprove of. I just do for my own reasons. I don't like the way they market to kids. I don't like their product. I think Coke is not so good for you.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong with a Coke. I'm not a fucking vegan or a fanatic about this stuff. But I'm just saying that, you know... You do measure yourself to an extent on the lines you draw.
Right.
The lines that you're not willing to cross, and even the lines you are willing to defend.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that...
that's important to know as a writer?
Yeah. I mean, it's tough, especially, you know, being young. I feel like I would be dishonest if I pretended to... know what those are yet. You know, it's a constant sort of discovery, but there are certainly the things that I know from Word One, fuck this, there's just no way. And I've watched myself almost these out of body experiences in meetings where some producer will be pitching me an idea and, you know, trying to get me into the idea of working on it. And I know from Word One, it's just nothing I would ever want to spend 5 minutes thinking about. And I'm totally bullshitting them and smiling and getting into it and even throwing out ideas.
You have to, though, right?
You kind of have to because I first...
Your agents expect it.
Right.
You've got a lot of people depending on you.
Yeah.
You're trying to make your name.
There's
a fuckload of pressure to play ball
and
to be in a lot of ways, a good earner in the beginning.
Totally. And then,
otherwise, you know, at 30, especially, 25, they're going to be like, dude.
Yeah, your agents, you know, they see you. And, you know, that's where the battle, that's the front line of the battle is with your representatives.
Yeah.
That's where they expect, you know, and want you to, look, if X-Men 9 comes your way, you better fucking jump for it.
Damn right.
Even if you don't want
it. Damn right.
And if you are going to be the artsy fucking auteur writer who's going to balk at a comic book franchise, next.
Listen, my, or rep my someone ex, else. My dear friend, Patty Jenkins, wrote a movie, I mean, I'm sorry, directed Wonder Woman.
Right.
And I think to the tune of $180 million,
sure.
You know, whatever it is. And, you know, she has her passion products, but projects, but she's always been into it because she knew that even though it was a comic book genre, she could make it amazing.
Right.
She could put her stamp on it, her, you know.
And those are the people you want directing the franchise projects, the Joss Whedons or the Patty Jenkins, people who are real artists and who are really good at what they do.
You need to meet her. Have you met her?
I have not. You did yet another act of early generosity in my career. You sent her something I wrote and she gave me notes. It was amazing.
She did give you notes?
Yeah. It was a long time ago. Yeah.
We gotta have dinner.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Let's make that happen so I can put you guys together.
Yeah.
They call me the Apex.
Yeah. Yeah. Brian was my agent before I had an agent.
I just think some people are worth it. So I would have been a great agent.
You really would. It's hilarious.
I
would have
been a great agent. Yeah. I should have been. I probably should have been an agent and not an actor.
And I'll tell you, agents get a bad rap, but the ones who are good and the ones who, you know, do it well.
They know, again, who's worth what.
Yeah.
And they know, you know, they have a sense of what projects make sense.
Right. And they play a crucial role, you know.
I wonder if I could get a job at CAA as an agent. Maybe I could buy that house I want.
There you go.
Be on the phone. I'd actually kind of, I think it'd be funny, just give it all up and be an agent and be on the phone all the time. I'd probably go crazy, but.
Yeah, it's not a job that I would want. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, there's a lot of bullshit involved in that job.
Yeah.
I mean, it's business, you know, and you rep three writers, all of whom are going after the same assignment. You got to lie to two of them and God disappoint damn. The third one. It's just fucking brutal.
Yeah.
But, yeah. You know.
Yeah. Managing personalities.
Yeah.
So what, at 25, you're kind of doing what a lot of people want to do at 50.
Yeah.
So what do you see yourself doing when you're 35, 40.
I don't know. You know, I don't know that I can assert myself as one of those people who, this is what I'm going to do forever. This is my only thing. I fucking love, I do love this, but I hope I do something else at
like
some
what?
Point. I have no idea.
But I mean, you'll always be a writer.
I will always be a writer. And it's funny.
See, you know what it sounds like? It's great because you're being romantic because this is you lying to yourself. You're caught.
Probably.
Writers like you are unfortunately, you're stuck.
Yeah.
You're always going to be a writer. You're always going to live this fucking problem. And that problem is going to be, how do I get myself out of this scene?
Yeah.
How do I get this person from point A to point, you know, omega? How do I get this person, how do I get this audience to want what this person wants?
Yeah.
How do I deal with this? And what the fuck is going on with me anyway?
Yeah, and writing is one of those things that even when, you know, the feeling when you have a lot of shit to do and you're just not getting it done in the day?
Yeah.
And you sit on the computer for an hour watching YouTube videos or fucking around and it's 5 o'clock and you're like, God damn it, I haven't got anything done. And you feel like
shit. Right.
If I don't write, even like I will feel that way. Even if I don't have an assignment to do, there is this sense of delinquent responsibility that I haven't fulfilled.
Yes,
I need to be doing, and that's kind of frightening because
Lanford Wilson, the great writer, he wrote Burn This, great playwright. You're a little before your time, a lot before your time, and I met him and I said, are you writing? And he said, and I was like, God, here's Lanford Wilson. And he said, I'm not. And I'm fine with it for the first time in my life. And he was about 68.
Right.
It was great.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's also one of those pursuits where, fuck, I mean, just the family sense of obligation as well. I mean, there's an enormous amount of support that comes from a family when you say, I'm going to go off and be a fucking film writer. It's like, okay, you know, that requires a pretty hefty amount of good faith and support from the family. So that
I met your dad. I liked him very much, though.
Yeah. No,
your father seemed, what I was really impressed with your father was, first of all, he's a very personal, intelligent guy. But what I noticed about your dad, well, what I noted, what spoke volumes about who he is as a person was that his restaurant, Jack's, that mm-hmm. we went to, mm-hmm. those people had been working there for a long time.
Yeah.
And I think you would probably see that in a lot of his restaurants.
Yeah.
When you're a boss and people work for you for a long time, it means you're fair. It means you are, you make people feel valued.
Mm-hmm.
And you understand that power doesn't just come from domination and force. It actually is about making other people feel valued, powerful, dignified. And I think your dad, am I wrong about that?
Oh, no, absolutely. He is. Yeah. I mean, every shred of acumen or, you know, business related negotiation sense or just general interpersonal skills I have as it relates to getting things done professionally, learned from him.
Yeah.
I mean, he, and you know, we're not talking about a guy who went to business school or anything like that. He, you know, was flipping burgers at 16, got an associate's at the Culinary Institute in New York, and has been cooking his whole life and just started opening restaurants, but
wow,
has succeeded at a business level at a really high level just through his own kind of, you know.
Well, see, now you came from money, but you're a hungry dude.
Yeah. I mean, we're, you know,
maybe that comes from being sick when you were younger. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I would never label myself as, you know, some hungry dude. Maybe it's just the nature of writing, because it's such a sedentary kind of quiet pursuit that even in the more aggressive moments of pursuing writing, it doesn't feel like you're doing something aggressive or hungry.
Yeah,
it's very quiet
and kind of muscle
slow. Yeah,
it requires like daydreaming.
Right, it's like a big work day for me is just staring at the fucking wall for 8 hours thinking of stuff. So it's like,
see, I'm sorry, but for me, writing and writers, because like people like say, you know, who are the most impressive people? For me, they're always writers, because it's so difficult. You have to wait till something happens.
Yeah.
You do. You spend so much time staring at a wall. And I've tried it forever. And I've only done it well with one axe, I guess. And well, I'm saying that to myself. I don't even know if that's true. But it's so difficult. And yeah. I can't do it. I don't know how to do it. But I envy people who can.
It's a strange, you know, it's a strange way to spend the day. And I think especially for people around you and close to you who don't write, you know, a work day can often entail, you know, you're not touching a keyboard, you're not writing a note, you know, maybe every once in a while, but you're just sitting there thinking.
Yeah.
A lot of times you just have to do that. And it's crucial, but I think it's tough for people to understand, well, what are you doing? What the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
But, you know, that's how you kind of have to spend your time. But, you know, yeah, I definitely was, this is definitely something I always wanted to do and definitely made it happen. You know, it's part of what I think has helped me succeed is a sense of, you know, I didn't pursue a degree with much commitment. This was kind of always my thing since mm-hmm. I was in middle school. It was, you know, Harry wants to, you know, work in film in some capacity. So it kind of felt like I gotta fucking make this happen somehow. Yeah. No family connections in Hollywood, no anything.
Did you go by Harry?
Yeah, Harry or Harrison. Quarry. Both. Harry Query sounds weird, so Harrison's a little better. But
Harrison sounds very aristocratic.
Yeah, it does.
Harrison.
Yeah, Harrison.
Please, Harrison.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't know. I definitely think it's...
Well, the answer is you're going to be writing the rest of your life.
Yeah, probably.
Sorry.
However long
Sorry,
that is.
Sorry, but you are.
Yeah.
And by the way, wishing you were a boxer like me or a fighter.
Exactly.
Watching. I mean, you know, part of being a writer, really, let's be honest, is wishing you were anybody else.
Totally. Every character I write is... Harrison's fucking daydream alternate persona number 832.
Who would you like to be if you had to be someone and you had 10 seconds to decide?
God.
I'm going to give you 10 seconds. 10, 9.
Combination of Sebastian eight. Younger and Tim Kennedy. Either one. Somewhere in the
funny.
Middle.
That's funny. So a badass.
A badass. Someone who fucking
but you
doesn't
know,
care.
You know, I have to say, at my age, and when I was your age, I would have said the same thing, a variation of that, but at my age, There is the notion of being a Spartan, you know, men mm-hmm. who can take great hardship and
yeah.
kill a sentry with a knife and
yeah.
and mainly be brave.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Brave. It's the bravery.
It's great. But, you know, I have come to admire people that create, that innovate, that come up with something. I actually think that's harder. And I won't say more valuable, because if we didn't have guys like Tim Kennedy out there, we would be in trouble.
Yeah,
We need people to defend those walls. We just do.
Yeah. Man.
You know, there are people that look at the Mongols. I mean, you know, you Baghdad was the center of learning and you know, poetry, and the Mongols came in and fucking killed everybody and burned their libraries.
Yeah.
They needed guys like Tim Kennedy and technology that killed people.
If you look at...
I fantasize about being on the walls of Baghdad with a couple of helicopter gunships, and I want a fucking sniper rifle and with a team of snipers, and I want to just kill Mongols. I want to shoot them right off their fucking horses. In fact, sorry, everybody, I want to shoot their fucking horses first. So now they're on horseback.
Yep.
I mean, now they're on foot. Then I want to ride up on those motherfuckers with machetes. That's just me. I actually fantasize about being having 2016 technology in 1260 or 20 or 40 or whenever the siege of Baghdad happened.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's definitely a sense of being the, you know, the privileged arm of society, sitting in my safe, warm home and writing fucking stories while guys like Tim Kennedy are out there.
But Tim would probably say, and has said, in fact,
that's why he does it.
That's why he does it.
Yeah.
That Memorial Day, when he sees people who were not in combat, didn't know the horrors of combat, and they're having barbecues and smiling. Well, that's why
right.
he's the sheepdog.
Right.
Tim keeps us safe from the wolves. And the rest of us, by the way, if you don't know who Tim Kennedy is, he's a Green Beret special operator and top, I'm going to give him the 185-pound division, top three fighter in the world.
Yeah.
I'm not even saying top five. You fight Tim Kennedy, you better pack a fucking lunch. I mean, you better pack a lunch. Yeah. And I don't care if you're Luke Rockhold. I don't care who you are. Hector Lombard, Yoel Romero, two-time world champion wrestler. Tim Kennedy is bringing it, and he's a nightmare. So,
yeah. Yeah. No, I think that they, you know, I definitely would agree that's sort of the what drives them. But
a culture, I'm eating cheese as we speak. A culture is, the cornerstone of a culture is its artistic expression.
Mm-hmm.
It is.
Yeah.
It's painting. It's music. It's film.
Yeah.
It's, you know, story.
There, you know, I in my more maybe delusional or proud moments can kind of convince myself of that hopefully I'm contributing to some kind of cultural value by writing something that will someday be a meaningful film to somebody. You know, there is, I think, especially with screenwriting as opposed to even the novel, which for some reason feels like a more dignified medium, but there is the sense sometimes that movies, you know, with the exception of very few, are pretty much an expendable and kind of unnecessary addition to our culture.
Movies?
That I could just stop doing what I'm doing and nobody's
movies,
really at a loss.
Movies teach you how to act sometimes when nobody's there to teach you how to act. Movies can... I was talking to Tito Ortiz, the fighter. I said, what was your... You didn't have a lot of guidance growing up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you had a dad or something. And he said, movies.
Yeah.
Movies teach you how to win and lose and those old motifs, archetypes, and things like that.
Certainly so, for me. I mean, when I think of my childhood and the important moments of my childhood, a lot of times what's flashing in the kind of theater of my mind are not experiences I actually had, but scenes from movies that I grew up on. You know,
what are the seminal movies in your life?
Oh, fuck. You know, I think back to, you know, the kind of classic stuff when I was young, watching The Family, the Forrest Gumps and the Shawshanks of the world, those kind of bigger, sweeping films. You know, my mom nurturing my my interest at a very young age. Started bringing me to the Telluride Film Festival every year.
Wow.
Yeah, for fucking 10 years in a row, maybe more.
What a mom.
Yeah, it was amazing. And it was just her and I, and every Labor Day weekend we would go up to Telluride. And Telluride Film Festival is incredible. The best film festival you can go to this day. Wow. If you want to go to a film festival.
I did not.
The best one. I mean, I think it's now probably 15 years in a row that the film that wins Best Picture and probably Best Actor and Actress will premiere at Telluride.
Wow.
Like, almost without exception.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's not got the glitz and the press of Cannes or Sundance. You know, it's just a mountain town. Everybody's just kicking around on the street, but it is a high-level festival. Wow. But in addition to the big movies, it was, you know, a constant stream of movies that you would otherwise, especially at my age, started going when I was 11, I would never have seen, you know, the fucking obscure Croatian indie movie that only might have screened there, and, you know, you couldn't even get it on video.
So what about the novels? What are the novels that you remember? Like, when you ask me certain novels, right away that pop into my head is mm-hmm. Blood Meridian, mm-hmm. Dick. I mean, yeah. I just have certain novels.
I mean, Cormac McCarthy was definitely a huge one, and certainly for the kind of style that I like writing, which mm-hmm. hopefully...
Hemingway?
Hemingway, some of Hemingway, for sure.
Bernard, I only ask because you're younger, so it's yeah. seminal for me. But maybe
Bernard Cornwell...
never read anything by him.
He's great. He writes a lot of stuff that's, you know, it's period. A lot of it's set in, you know, the 1700s or the 1800s, but, you know, so in and around the Napoleonic Wars.
Before vaccines, everyone.
Yes, long before
and
vaccines.
And antibiotics. Yeah. Life was fun, and dentistry, and plumbing.
Yeah.
You shat in basically a dish.
Yeah.
A bowl.
I mean, that is sort of the...
And the play. Keep going.
That's sort of the dream would be someday...
Slavery,
I think,
to everyone.
To write a novel. You know, I think that would be... That would be... at times, I feel like that's sort of what I'm trying to build toward.
Right.
Because I feel like, especially nowadays, that's a privileged position. There's so few novels that anybody wants to pay for or commission anymore.
Oh, man, I know.
That you kind of need to already succeed in order to have that's anybody true. Bother letting you write
I've been
a novel.
Writing, I've been reading too much nonfiction. I want to start reading some novels. That, I might just read novels from now on.
I haven't cracked a novel in. All I read is nonfiction.
Yeah,
now.
It's bullshit.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm tired of it. I'm tired of reading these social scientists who basically, at the end of the day, basically say, hey, guess
We're
what?
We're fucked.
or be nice to each other.
Right.
Yeah. Evolution says, you know.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, I think it's crucial, especially for screenwriting. I think that, you know... I kind of skirted your question of advice, but if I do have any, it would be informed. You know, it's a pleasant surprise that a lot of times producers and even agents, they want to know that what you're bringing to the table is somewhat substantiated in an understanding of the world.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it is you're writing about, be it a fucking thriller about drug smuggling or a romantic comedy, if you're backing it up with some sense of knowledge or reality.
You know, I think when you're informed and you have knowledge... I think you tend to be more fair too.
Yeah.
You know, because you have an idea specifically of why something is bad.
Right.
So, you know, fucking corporations, the banks.
Right.
Big pharma.
Right.
Well, okay, but you need to know what about those institutions that provide value.
Right.
There are things that may be unfair, their practices, their incentive structures.
Right.
There are things about those large leviathans that are responsible for certain evils, maybe,
right.
If you want to get really dramatic about it. Okay, but you need to know, first of all, how they work and why they work that way, to be fair.
And you can see the difference in films that are written by those who actually have an understanding of the subject matter and those who don't. You know, when you watch a movie like Syriana, by, you know, Steve Gagan wrote and directed it, actually. That's a really well thought out and complex story based on, I think,
of course,
roughly.
My dad was furious at it because when my father, who worked at a bank and mm-hmm. probably worked for an intelligence agency, I don't know.
Right.
But my father, who was knee deep in that part mm-hmm. of the world for 16, 17 years, when he saw that talk at the board meeting when they were talking about oil and what they're going to do, he had to turn it off.
Cause what about that was
bullshit? The idea that somehow that there was sort of that oil and American corporations, you know, that there was this organized movement
to destabilize the Middle East.
Yeah, it was complete horseshit.
You think so?
Yes, because no one is talking to each other that way. Americans aren't going, let's destabilize the Middle East. Americans were, I'm telling you, I live there. The guys, they were, I don't give a fuck who's listening and who disagrees. Let me explain something to you. Men, like, they're like you and I. They're in a country.
Mm-hmm.
They have a job. They work for a big bank. They have to report. They have to make, I'm talking even top guys. They have to come up with, you know, they have to come up with essentially, they have to make money, but the idea that we're going to destabilize the Middle East, that it makes sense to keep it destabilized, that the CIA had an interest, I guess, in keeping things, keeping turmoil. I can understand the argument, but there was really, I think, more a question of, I bet you if you spoke to most CIA operatives, they were guys who said, look, man, democracy is better than communism. Right. The Russians are trying to get a foothold in, you know, Saudi Arabia or wherever it might be. And the Arabs, they may have been naive enough to say the Arabs should be more like us Americans or more like hold to the ideals of the founding fathers.
Right.
And so, you know, if there's a guy who's more like that than this other guy who's more of a communist sympathizer, then we should support this group over here because those guys have an ideology that we believe is not good. I think it was more along those philosophical lines.
But I think for sure both. But I think the problem in a lot of people's diagnosis of that whole issue is they make it too black and white.
Yes,
the notion that,
that's right.
The notion that...
It's never black and white like that.
The notion that anybody, that American interests, that anyone, be it the CIA or banks or even the president, was empowered with enough agency to say, okay, let's destabilize the Middle East for the purposes of oil. It's ridiculous.
Washington and corporations...
They can't get anything done.
Different points of view.
Yeah, but what is reasonable, I think, is to say, okay, turmoil has arisen in the Middle East and that American interests, in an opportunistic way, say, wow, there's profit to be reaped via this destabilization. Is it as straight of a line as CIA?
Maybe, though, because the problem with that thought is also then you have to send Americans over there and a lot of people are like, I don't want to go there. It's fucking dangerous.
But
a lot of money on Iraq. Who made money on Iraq? Halliburton? They keep talking about this. Really? I don't know.
I think that there's...
We lost a shitload of money. We got none of the oil revenue.
I think the question is, who is we? If we're talking about the federal government, that's one thing. If we're talking about the private interests who were being represented by the federal government, they made a lot of money. I mean, the no-bid contracts, the arms manufacturers.
They'll say
they're going to bring down the towers. And
but they made a lot of money what? Off of what? American... tax dollar. I mean, the federal government. It wasn't like they made money off the Iraqis.
No, they made money off of it's war profiteering. Yes. I mean, I definitely, the notion that we brought down the Twin Towers.
The U.S. made money off itself, I suppose.
Right.
So really, corporations preyed on the U.S. government.
In an opportunistic way. They say, wow, look at this mess they're in. Yeah. There's profit to be made.
That's where the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned against comes into play.
But people paint it as this, you know, mustache-twirling thing where in the White House they're saying, let's knock down the Twin Towers so we can make money. That's ridiculous.
Blame it on momentum.
Yeah, it's
human momentum on like the things start. We got to, hey, listen, man, these fucking guys, all I'm telling you is that, you know, Al-Qaeda could, you know, become friends with Saddam Hussein and he'll help them make a nuclear bomb.
Right.
You got a mushroom cloud over fucking New York. That was a real fear.
Sure.
I get it. People are like, you know, let's show the fourth largest army and a guy who started three wars.
Yeah.
Let's show him that if he thinks there's any profit in a mushroom cloud over Europe or the United States, that it's going to be the end of his fucking life. Okay,
yeah.
I understand that. That's a rational, calculated argument, which, by the way, had a lot of detractors.
Sure. And I think once that ball gets rolling, there's people who recognize a financial opportunity and the conflict that's going to arise from that situation.
Yes.
But anyway, as it relates to what we were talking about, if you take the complexities of that kind of situation and you need to pack it into a 90-minute film, I think that having the simplicity of a guy in a boardroom talking to an oil representative, there you go. That delivers it in a very clean, packaged way, which, you know, it's not
I just worry because a lot of people form their point of view and opinion.
Yeah.
But they always will. I mean, the movie.
I think, though, that's a movie that, despite the unrealistic nature of literally a banker talking to an oil rep about destabilizing the Middle East, the sentiment of that conversation, that opportunistic ideal, is a legitimate one to present. And you know, that's a writer who was informed on what he was writing and knew what he was doing. And then you watch, you know, Green Zone by Paul Greengrass, which, great filmmaker, nothing bad to say about him, but that's a bullshit movie.
Yeah.
And you can just tell so, that was, you know, he watched 30 minutes of Michael Moore and decided to write a movie.
That's right.
So,
Harrison Quarry, we are, this has been fun, and we are
out of time.
Yeah. Well, no, I keep it short and tight, but we're at an hour almost.
Okay.
And, you've been great. So
it's a full circle moment for me. My career started with a Brian Callen podcast, and hopefully it'll continue with one right in the middle.
You're always welcome. I love talking to you. We need to spend more time together.
We do.
And hang out because you're indeed. Fun and you're intelligent and you're a breath of fresh air. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to be in St. Louis this coming weekend, June 9, 10, and 11, St. Louis Helium. Get your tickets, but only if you like laughing super hard. Harrison Quarry will be somebody that you will, Harry Quarry, will be somebody you'll hear about for many years to come. He will put fun stories in your eyes and in your ears. This is the mother of all podcasts, The Brian Callen Show.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.